This is 40A&M N5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. Australia surprises with a proposal for data retention. Apple Pay? Well, not at CVS or Rite Aid. And quantitative easing? Now a thing of the past. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40A&M in 5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, November 3rd, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, everyone from Wall Street Journal to ZDNet to The Guardian, BBC, and Huffington Post are talking this past week about the Australian government's surprise move to table a mandatory data retention bill. As proposed, data about phone and computer use will be retained by companies for up to 2 years under the proposal tabled before Parliament. The bill, which in some respects mirrors a push that was made by law enforcement in Australia some 7 years ago, would give access to what has been termed customer metadata without a warrant. Australian Communications Commissioner Malcolm Turnbull told Parliament in a statement that was released to the press that access to metadata plays a central role in almost every investigation, and authorities had been hampered in investigations given lack of access to this metadata. He added, "Illegal downloads, piracy, cyber crimes, cybersecurity, all these matters. Our ability to investigate them is absolutely pinned to our ability to retrieve and use metadata." Problematically, for rights advocates, the legislation does not specify what metadata might entail or what the scope of collected information collected under this definition might be limited to over time. But according to the government, it would not include the content of calls or emails, web browsing history, or website addresses. This new legislation reflects the effort undertaken in Europe and elsewhere in 2005-2006, when Europe passed its data retention directive. But many other jurisdictions, including Australia, the US, and others, decided ultimately not to pursue similar measures. The EU's data retention directive was ruled this past year to be in conflict with the European Charter of Human Rights by the European Court of Justice, as part of a case taken before it by Irish as well as other complainants. The legislation in Australia is a second component in that government's national security reforms, as on Wednesday of this past week, the Australian Senate passed its Foreign Fighters Bill to permit the government to suspend passports on short notice and make it an offense to travel to certain areas without a valid reason. The data retention bill is expected to get stiff opposition from the Greens, Liberal Democrat, and Independent wings of the Parliament, and the Labour Party has requested more community consultation before the bill is taken up. For the second time in as many months, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission has announced the largest privacy action in its history. In September, it reached a $7.4 million settlement with Verizon to address marketing issues. Eclipsing that this past week, the FCC's Enforcement Bureau's investigation backed a $10 million fine for Terracom and Yortel. From September 2012 through April 2013, the firms apparently stored Social Security numbers, names, addresses, driver's license, and other sensitive customer information on unprotected servers that anyone in the world could access via the Internet. The firms had gathered this information primarily from low-income consumers in order to have them demonstrate eligibility for the Lifeline program, a universal service fund program to provide discounted phone services. The resulting breach impacted up to 305,000 customers, according to the Bureau, exposing each to potential theft and fraud. And even after the companies learned of the security lapses and the breaches, according to the FCC's release, they allegedly failed to notify all potentially impacted consumers, depriving them of any opportunity to take steps to protect their information from misuse. The FCC alleges that the company's actions violate their statutory duties under the Communications Act, and that the deceptive and misleading representations, as to customer data security and privacy protections, coupled with the failure to notify of the breach, constituted unjust and unreasonable practices as well. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission also had significant activity in the telecom space last week. The FTC filed a federal court complaint on Tuesday, the 28th, against AT&T Mobility LLC, charging that the company misled millions of its smartphone customers by charging them for unlimited data plans while reducing their data speeds, in some cases by nearly 90%. For a time, AT&T was the exclusive mobile provider to Apple's iPhone, and in 2007, it first offered its unlimited data plans to these customers for $20 per month. It dropped the unlimited plan in 2010 for new customers, but by that time, millions of customers had already taken up the plan and were grandfathered into continuing coverage under its terms. The FTC alleges that AT&T began throttling data speeds in 2011 for its unlimited data plan customers after these customers used as little as 2 gigabytes of data in a billing period. And according to the FTC's complaint, the throttling program has often resulted in speed reductions of 80 to 90% for impacted users, affecting at least 3.5 million unique users, a total of more than 25 million times. The reduction or throttling of data speeds allegedly occurred to a degree that many typical mobile phone applications, like web browsing, GPS navigation, and streaming video viewing, became difficult, if not nearly impossible, to accomplish. The FTC said that billions of unlimited mobile data plan customers had elected to keep their plan rather than switch to a tiered mobile data plan or obtain service from another provider. And now to legal bases. The FTC's complaint charges that AT&T violated the FTC Act by changing the terms of customers' unlimited data plans while those customers were still under contract, and also failed to adequately disclose the nature of the throttling program to consumers who renewed their unlimited data plans. For its part, AT&T Mobility, the second largest mobile carrier in the U.S., called the charges baseless and baffling, claiming that it had clearly communicated changes in its policies to its customers. AT&T Senior Executive Vice President and General Counsel Wayne Watts said last week, "The FTC's allegations have nothing to do with the substance of our network management program, and it's baffling to see why the FTC would choose to take this action against a company that, like all major wireless providers, manages its network resources to provide the best possible service to all customers. We informed all unlimited data plan customers via bill notices and a national press release that resulted in nearly 2,000 news stories well before the plan was implemented," he added. According to the complaint, the FTC staff worked closely on this matter with the Federal Communications Commission, and the FTC's move follows on from an announcement that the Federal Communications Commission is investigating the throttling practices of the major mobile carriers. The FTC's vote authorizing the complaint was a unanimous 5-0, filing the action in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, San Francisco Division. A week after Apple's high-profile startup of Apple Pay, its mobile wallet feature, retailers, CVS, and Rite Aid stores both barred the use of Apple Pay in its stores. Both firms are part of a group of retailers that are developing their own payment system called Currency, with partners Walmart, Best Buy, and 7-Eleven. According to National Public Radio's Bill Chappell, a key goal of the group of refusenik retailers may be to cut out major credit card companies from this new and expected to be burgeoning payment scheme, and also reportedly build customer loyalty and data tracking through points programs and store credit cards. In its release of Apple Pay last week, Apple highlighted that it has partnered, for a cut of the transactions, with Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, as well as Wells Fargo and other major banks, to cover more than 80% of the credit card purchase market in the U.S. However, the decision by CVS and Rite Aid last week to block use of Apple Pay in favor of a new proprietary payment scheme among a coalition of companies does seem a bit of a throwback to the days where retail customers filled their wallet with numerous separate gas company and department store purchasing cards. As pointed out last week by Forbes, sooner or later, consumers are bound to become confused. Which phone can I use? As Apple, for instance, does not support Google Wallet. Which payment type does the retailer accept? And with that confusion, will go the convenience factor. In some respects, this developing story also goes to highlight that some markets have long been in the business of mobile money and mobile banking, particularly those markets for whom mobile phone usage represents the best lifeline to the internet, and also for whom credit cards and physical banking has long been a scarcer commodity. The Brookings Institution's policy blog site published a fantastic article this past week by senior fellow Mwangi Kimenyi, detailing the fits and starts that Kenya has gone through, and continues to go through, in developing its mobile banking sector. He highlighted that in Kenya, commercial banks began by introducing products that linked to the services being offered by their mobile phone companies, But today in Kenya, commercial banks have ratcheted up their operations to full mobile banking, including the introduction of their own SIM cards, instead of relying on those issued by the mobile phone providers. To Mr. Kimani's analysis, the key to Kenya's successful mobile banking industry is to encourage innovation to thrive, but also at the same time to ensure that its regulatory agencies work continuously to evaluate and manage potential risks and maintain the continued integrity of the developing sector. Mr. Kimani's piece on Kenya mobile banking can be found at www.brookings.edu/blogs/Africa-in-focus. For those of us who were and still remain fans of the television show Seinfeld, an event that happened late last week might be seen as somewhat reminiscent of a favorite tagline from one of Seinfeld's most memorable episodes. A decision by the Federal Reserve's policymaking board amounted to a decision that, in a macroeconomic sense, was them essentially saying, no more soup for you. I'm talking about quantitative easing, of course, and the Fed's decision to end a program of binge bond buying that began in the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown, November 2008 to be exact. The QE program began after the Fed pushed the short-term funds rate to zero, which would have traditionally spurred businesses and consumers to borrow at cheaper rates, but that did not happen. In total, the Federal Reserve, in regularly buying bonds since that date, has added $3.7 trillion worth of assets to its holdings, which is about an eightfold increase. The stock market has particularly loved the QE program, as much of the injection of capital into the economy has come back to the market in investments, one of the primary reasons why the Fed has taken pains to ensure full disclosure that QE would be ending soon. The monthly bond purchases were at a high of $85 billion in December to just $15 billion last month, as the Fed had begun cutting back on the monthly purchases for about a year, a self-professed glide path toward ending the program entirely. Now, QE certainly didn't prevent a recession, and it hasn't generated a particularly strong recovery, though for many this latter impact wasn't the goal. It had, arguably, prevented a far worse downturn in the economy. The Fed in particular cited last week that unemployment is today lower and economic activity higher, and that is likely otherwise than it would have been. As the Fed concluded its two-day meeting last week, it also reiterated a pledge to keep its benchmark short-term interest rates near zero for a considerable time now that QE has ended. At the Fed's meeting in mid-September, Chair Janet Yellen cited low unemployment rates as being a key indicator that will likely tick up rates again in the future, although it's not likely to be soon. Mid to late 2015, perhaps a possibility, but the Fed is certainly not setting a timeline. When the decision is made, it will depend much on the incoming data on inflation and signs in the labor market, as well as the economy at least continuing its recovery at the present moderate pace, as the Fed called it last week. Long-term unemployment continues to be a serious problem, particularly among those who are no longer counted within the unemployment rolls, because they've either timed out of its data, or are not looking for work, but would like to work, or both. But with the end of QE this past week, although the Fed is ending its doling out of monetary soup, so to speak, their confidence that the marketplace is now in a far better footing to be making its own soup is probably well placed. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40 A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from the relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the Brookings Institution, National Public Radio, and Forbes. Thank you for listening. 40 A&M in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, November 10th. Until then, of course, make this week, and every week, one to remember. And bye for now.